you've reached Dual Parallel. I can't make it to the show right now, but if you please leave your name and number, Radio Freak America 15 will get back to you as soon as it can.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.
Welcome to Radio Freak America 15. I am not Dual Parallel. Dual, as you heard, is unavailable this week. He is, as they say in TV land, off on assignment. And who was that, Walter Cronkite or somebody that used to be off on assignment? Well, turns out years later, people found out that assignment was the name of his yacht. So when he said he was off on assignment, he wasn't lying. They weren't lying to you. The media wouldn't lie to you. They were stretching the truth. Well, they weren't even really even stretching the truth. They were telling you the truth. Technically, he was on assignment. They just didn't tell you that assignment was the name of a boat. So anyway, Dual is not on Walter Cronkite's yacht or anything like that. He's working hard and wasn't going to be able to do the show today. So I stepped in and, my name is Rax, in case you're tuning in for the first time. Dual is the phone freak in the crew. I'm the hacker. I'm the hack. I'm one who gets my jollies on figuring out clever kinds of solutions to things. Or, well, maybe sometimes they're clever. Maybe sometimes they're not so clever, but one of the things that we do here on Radio Freak America is give out free knowledge. And that's one of the things, that's sort of a hackish term, the Radio Freak America. You know, like Radio Free America, well, the free K is free knowledge. And it's also kind of a word play on freak, like phone freak, which is what Dual's forte is. But I want to talk to you tonight about hacking. And we're going to go back a little bit in time and look at the origins of hacking and see where and why and how come hacking has gotten to be a dirty word. Well, the blame it on the media, if you will. You know, Dual is always on the sign out of the show. He always says, be the media. Well, why do you want to be the media, Dual? Well, you've got to do something. You can't just sit back and let them pour all that schlop on you on TV or on regular radio. So that's why avenues like this and Rant Radio are so cool, because they give you and me and anyone out there who cares to take the time to do it, gives them an opportunity to give their viewpoint. And hacking goes back, quite a ways. I mean, you know, there's hackers, golfers call themselves hackers, and, you know, it's someone who's not a professional. But, you know, hacking kind of got started, as it got applied to computers and technology anyway, got started at MIT, yes, good old Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And hacking was something that people did there. I mean, it was a higher education institute dealing with technology. Duh, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It wasn't institutes of sports or medicine or whatever. It was about technology. And technology can take various types of forms. Of course, they're doing all kinds of nifty things at MIT these days. But hackers, back in the day, when things got started, were mainly computer programmers. And they would work hard, and they would be diligent, and they'd be there all night, and, oh yeah, they forgot to take a bath or a shower when they came in today because, well, doggone it, it's just so important to work on that program and get it all figured out. Who can afford to take the extra 5 minutes to take a shower? So, but hackers, aside from that less than admirable trait, had the tendency to be very diligent and work on things and come up with clever solutions to things. And not only would they find those solutions, they would tell other people, they would tell their peers, they would tell other hackers, hey, I found this really cool way of doing this. I found a neat way around, maybe getting this donated super secret Xerox laser printer that's in the mid-70s at Richard Stallman, had to deal with, and he's being one of the quintessential hackers of our day. And we'll talk a little bit more about Stallman later on. But there was a problem with printing, and they couldn't get into things. They couldn't get the source code because, unlike in the hacker tradition where you share that information, people at Xerox decided to start doing this thing called proprietary software. And with the proprietary software, they just kept all that stuff to themselves. Well, hackers didn't do that. Hackers shared their knowledge. So when someone found a solution to something, someone invented a better mouse trap or came up with a better algorithm for sorting or whatever, they would share it with everybody. Why should someone else have to reinvent the wheel? I just figured out this, you know, cool binary tree or bubble sort algorithm. I want to share it with everybody. Let them, you know, I've done all the hard work on it. Let them benefit by it. That way people won't have to spend their brain cycles on figuring out a way to sort data. They can build on what I've done and take it from there and come up with other great things. Well, that's what hackers originally were, and that's where the term came from, or as near as urban legend can tell it, that's the sort of area that it came from. But hacking and hackers, like everything else, the media got a hold of and twisted it around to their own liking, to their own devices. Because face it, folks, the media is out there to sell. And think about it. You watch the 11 o'clock news or 10 o'clock news or whatever time it comes on for you, and what are they talking about? Hey, this cool thing happened or that cool thing happened. No, it's this train wreck happened and this fire is going on and this many people were killed. Well, I don't know what it is about our society, but it's kind of like an accident at the side of the road. You just gotta watch. You just gotta rubberneck, you know? We've got this rubberneck society where people just have to stop and look and see the tragedy that's going on somewhere else. Well, the media knows that people like that, and they sell that. They sell advertising, right? That's how they make their money, one of their ways. So if people didn't have all this rubbernecking kind of icky stuff to look at, fires and theft and God knows what else, who'd watch the news? Well, maybe you'd watch for the weather. Yeah, that's okay. Maybe you'd watch for the sports scores, or if you're into that kind of thing or whatever. But the media found out that that other kind of stuff sells. The dirty laundry, as the song goes. So the media wants to make money. Hey, they're big corporate America, or corporate insert your own country here, because we know that listeners out there are, we've got listeners in Germany and Norway. And hey, if you're listening from one of the other countries, please do feel free to email us. Go to oldschoolfreak, PHREAK.com, and click on one of the links. Drop us a note. Let us know where you're listening to us from, and let us know how we're doing. Give us some ideas. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. And if you got some ideas, just share it. That's, you know, keep knowledge free. Share the knowledge. Keep the things going. So anyway, the media. They want to have people tune in because, hey, the more eyes that are glued to that set, or the more eyes that are reading that newspaper, does anyone read newspapers out there anymore, by the way? But the more eyes that are watching TV, the more they can sell that advertising space for the Abdominizer or whatever kind of thing, or fast food place. You know, the more people that are watching, the more they can charge, and that's how they make their money. So good news, unfortunately, folks, doesn't sell very much. Why do you think all the human interest stories, as they call them, appear at the end of the show? It's like, oh yeah, you know, we had this death and this war and this famine, and oh yeah, by the way, here's something really nice that someone in your community did. You know, they helped their fellow man. Isn't that special? Well, thanks for tuning in, folks. Be sure to watch for war and pestilence and famine and everything else tomorrow. Tune back in. Same bad time, same bad channel. So that's what the media wants to do. Well, as computers were coming along, they didn't understand it. They were afraid of it. And let's face it, everyone listening to the show right now probably knows someone, or knows someone who knows someone, that's afraid of technology. You know, the 12 o'clock flashers out there. Every appliance in their house is flashing at 12 o'clock because they have no idea how to quote-unquote program their VCR. They don't know how to set the clock on it, so they're just afraid of it. Hey, they think that microwave technology, like heat up your coffee in the morning or cook your Jiffy Pop popcorn, that's about the peak of technology. That's as much technology as they need to know. Stick a cup of water in there, turn the dial, push the button, and away you go. That's the technology they need. That's what Joe Sixpack out there wants. And let's face it, there's a lot of Joe Sixpacks out there. You know, guys who, and gals, whoever, come home from work, grab a beer, sit down in front of the boob tube, and watch and see what's going on. Well, the media, as they found out that, you know, these computer things were coming on, and there was these various stories, and, oh my goodness, look at this. Here's some dirty laundry. Here's some people who aren't necessarily playing by the rules. Hey, they're not coloring inside the lines. They're going outside of those lines a little bit. Well, there's got to be some name for them. There has to be some term for that. Oh, look at that. Hackers. Yeah, that's what they are. Those hackers, those programmers. That's what that guy is, that, or that girl is, that just broke into a computer or did something nasty. They must be a hacker. And unfortunately, Joe Sixpack sat back there and said, you know what? Doggone it, that is a hacker. Boy, them hackers are bad. But anyway, there's a lot more to it. But just an oversimplification, that's kind of where it came from. That's kind of how it got messed up. So hacking isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's not a bad thing in my book. I call myself a hacker. I like looking for creative solutions for things, finding out information, delving in, and then sharing that knowledge with other people. So if a hacker is someone who's enjoying the technology, finding out information, sharing that information, it's not necessarily a negative thing. What should someone who has negative intentions for using that technology be called? Well, some people have tried to use the term, or have tried to popularize the term, cracker, like a safe cracker, someone who's breaking into things, and you know, it just hasn't seemed to stick quite as well. People, the media, are still calling people hackers who are, you know, not necessarily bad, as the media tries to make it say. But there's a book, Active Defense, and I know we talked about this before on the show, but it's, since this is our hacker special, I'm going to read this again. It's Chris Brenton and Cameron Hunt wrote this book called Active Defense. And they've got a great passage in here that goes, people from trade magazine writers to Hollywood movie makers often use the words attacker, hacker, and cracker interchangeably. The phrase, we got hacked, has come to mean we were attacked. However, there are some strong distinctions between these three terms, and understanding the difference will help you to understand who is trying to help reinforce your security posture and who is trying to infiltrate it. An attacker is someone who looks to steal or disrupt your assets. An attacker may be technically adept or a rank amateur. An attacker is best resembles a spy or a crook. The original meaning of hacker was someone with a deep understanding of computers and or networking. Hackers are not satisfied with simply executing a program. They need to understand all the nuances of how it works. A hacker is someone who feels the need to go beyond the obvious. The art of hacking can either be positive or negative, depending on the personalities and motivations involved. Hacking has become its own subculture, with its own language and accepted social practices. It's probably human nature that motivates people outside of this subculture to identify hackers as attackers, or even anarchists. In my opinion, however, hackers are more like revolutionaries. History teems with individuals whose motivation was beyond the understanding of the mainstream culture of their time. Da Vinci, Galileo, Byron, Mozart, Tesla were all considered quite odd and out of step with the accepted social norm. In the information age, this revolutionary role is being filled by individuals we call hackers. Hackers tend not to take statements at face value. For example, when a vendor claims, quote, our product is 100% secure, unquote, a hacker may take this statement as a personal challenge. What a hacker chooses to do with the information uncovered, however, is what determines what color hat a particular hacker wears. To distinguish between hackers who are simply attempting to further their understanding of any information system and those that use knowledge to illegally or unethically penetrate systems, some in the computer industry use the term cracker to refer to the latter. This was an attempt to preserve the traditional meaning of the term hacker, but this effort has mostly been unsuccessful. Occasionally, publications still use the term. The law, however, does not recognize the difference in intent, only the similar behavior of the unauthorized system penetration. So I think it's a pretty good description. Hackers are trying to find out information. It's like any other kind of tool. Knowledge is power. Power can be used for good things and power can be used for bad things. You can have power like electricity to light your homes, or it can be used to carry out a death sentence, an execution, the electric chair. It's the same electricity that would be running through your house. Is the electricity bad because that's how it's used? No. What else? Airplanes, right? September 11th, still in the minds of most of the people around the world. An airplane's a wonderful tool. Those people who chose to use it as a weapon on September 11th perverted the use of that tool. So just because you have a tool does not mean that it's necessarily bad. The airplane itself wasn't inherently bad. Certainly all the other people who died, the passengers and the crew on the airplane, weren't bad. They didn't have evil intents. It's just those few people who went on there that had bad intents to do things. So hacking, with all its negative connotations, really can be, and is, in my opinion, a positive thing. You want to go beyond the obvious, as it said. You want to delve in, dig in, find out information. There's the Hacker's Dictionary. It's a book that, if you look it up online on your favorite search engine, you'll find that it is available online. And it defines all the little terms and the little techniques, and now not so much techniques, but terms that people use to identify things, and, you know, so hackish terms, just like any other subculture or any other group, you know, words and terms are developed and used for different meanings. And the Hacker's Dictionary does a pretty good job of keeping up with that stuff, so you can know what's going on with that. The editor of that, Eric Raymond, is the guy who edits that, and he wrote a little article in 2001, I guess, called How to Be a Hacker. And he just talks about it, and I think it's a really good read. Gives lots of information. The hacker / nerd connection. Of course, I prefer the term geek over nerd, but that's just a personal opinion. Talks about basic hacking skills and, you know, what you should do and why it's important to know some programming languages. It even gives some suggestions of some of the things in that to do with it. But hacking in itself is an art form. It can be used to, well, I make a living at computer technology. That's what I do. And I use my skills as a hacker, my creative thinking, to do more mundane things. Of course, it doesn't take a lot of creative thinking to format a hard drive or install an operating system. But when you come up with a problem, being able to think outside of that box, think creatively, remember reading something about, oh yeah, I remember someone read something about this, and someone wrote something about this. You know, let me look it up and see and get that information. Again, that's why it's so important that that sharing of knowledge, the sharing of information, keeping knowledge free is important. And that's one of the big creeds, if you will, the credos of the hacker culture, is to share that knowledge. And that's part of the thing that makes it so difficult for the open source community. Is they're working at sharing that knowledge and sharing the source code. And companies, Microsoft being one of them, certainly not the only one, but being a very influential one in that regard, closed down their source code, proprietary source code. You can find out, I think it's called A Letter to Hobbyists by Bill Gates, talking about why it's important for companies to close their source code. And it's kind of interesting. I was talking about this with someone else the other day, but for those of you that can remember back in about, what was it, 1987 or so, IBM came out with their PS2 line of computers. Computers were around before IBM. Personal computers were around before IBM, certainly, but the ones that were popularized, the IBM PC, the Intel standard, the IBM compatible, whatever you want to call it. IBM developed that specification, came out with it in about, you know, late 1981, early 1982. And it was very untypical IBM. I mean, they took off-the-shelf components. The 8088 chip was made by Intel. I'm not sure what else it was being used for at the time, but all the components that they had were off-the-shelf type of things. Hell, even their operating system was from this little little company up in Seattle, Washington, called Microsoft. They talked to Digital Research, who had an operating system, but that didn't go through. So they even took this off-the-shelf, quote-unquote, off-the-shelf operating system from this little, you know, nothing company called Microsoft up in Seattle, Washington, of all places. I mean, you know, IBM was headquartered in Boca Raton, Florida, and they had things in Armonk, New York, and all that other thing. But they took all these off-the-shelf components, put them together, and in another non-traditional IBM move, made those general specifications available. Now, they didn't let people just copy everything. They didn't open source the BIOS or anything else, but the specifications were published so other companies, other people could make components that were compatible. They could plug them in. Now, I know the Mac fans out in the audience there might be taking exception to some of this stuff, but think about it for a second, folks. You know, Macintosh is great computers. They always have been, but they were always very closed, very proprietary. And to Apple's credit, they've done a great job with it. They've kept the quality control, if you will. They specified everything from start to finish on Apple programs, not only the hardware itself, but any component that was going in there. They had all the specifications for the programs, and they've done a phenomenal job, especially of late. OS X, you know, being, well, we'll get into that a little bit later, but being, you know, Unix or Mach based for the kernel is building on all that work that had been done before. But IBM, in a non-traditional IBM type of move, made this type of information available. Well, you had companies like Compaq, which was formed of former HP engineers and other double E's, electronic engineers, coming together, and they reversed engineered it. Yet another traditional hacking type of thing. You look at the outputs that something does, you look at the inputs, and you figure out what went on in the middle. So here's an example. The output is a house. The input is a bunch of lumber and wires and pipes and whatever else. So you know what the output is, you know what the input is, so you figure out what goes in between. You figure out how to build that house. That's reverse engineering. And just for, you know, legal reasons, they got to make sure that anyone who's working on that, you know, didn't actually build the house or help build the house or anything. They have to keep that completely clean, so they're doing it, you know, just from that available information. But Compaq came along and reverse engineered things and came up with an IBM compatible computer. And that was great. And other companies came along. Well, what, they weren't so great necessarily at first, but eventually they got to be great. And we had all these compatible computers going around, and, you know, millions of people were buying them all over the world. Anyway, fast forward a little bit to 1987. IBM says, hey, wait a minute, you know, we developed this, we started this, here's Compaq and HP and all these other companies that are making money, we should be making that money. Well, let's take this standard and let's change it a little bit. Let's change the things. Instead of having these ISA slots, which are kind of slow, I mean, they were okay for their day, we're going to develop our own. Let's call it, microchannel architecture. And let's not quite publish everything like we did before. Let's make people license it from us. So if companies want to make cards, well, hey, they got to pay us royalties for that. If they want to, you know, other companies want to build compatible systems for that, hey, we license this technology. Other people can come and buy it from us, and we'll make money on it, whether we're selling it or someone else is selling it. And they did that. They came up with the PS2 keyboard connector and mouse connector rather than being serial mouse, or the 5-pin DIN, the larger one for a keyboard. They came out with all these other things. Bottom line, folks, some of the things stuck. PS2 mice and keyboard connectors, now that's pretty much gone, all gone to USB. The VGA, video graphics array, stuck with the PS2, but you know what IBM found out? They found out that the standard was bigger than IBM. Here, the company that quote-unquote pioneered the personal computer, we all know that's not true, but the company that pioneered the IBM personal computer was no longer in charge of the standard. Even though they had their name on it and they had the nice three little letters with the stripes in it that said IBM, they did not control, they couldn't control what people were doing. People didn't want to buy that. It was too different. It was non-standard. The changes didn't make it worthwhile enough to adopt it, to move over. So, after whatever kind of period of time, microchannel architecture finally died. The PS2 series of computers, yeah, they finally died too, boo-hoo. But that's what IBM found out. Matter of fact, there was something in the on the net today that IBM has gotten out of the hard drive business. I think they've turned that over to Fujitsu or somebody. But IBM used to make hard drives. Oh, here was a fun thing too, folks. When they came out with the PS2 line, IBM decided to change the terms. Everyone was calling it a hard drive. Well, IBM decided to call it a hard file. It wasn't a hard drive anymore. It was a hard file. And not only were they trying to change the hardware, they were trying to change the terms that people were using. It's like, it's a hard file. And the motherboard was, I think it was a planar board. It wasn't even a system board. I think it was a planar, P-L-A-N-A-R. It was a planar board. And people just said, you know what? Call it what you want, IBM. I'm still calling it a motherboard. I'm still calling it a hard drive. Anyway, they say those who can't remember history are doomed to repeat it. Take a look at what's going on now, folks. Microsoft is pushing really hard. They're pushing on their licensing technologies. Licensing technology. Yeah, they even call it License 6.0. Sounds like a product, doesn't it? Well, I got to upgrade my License 6.0, and that's exactly what they want you to do. They want you to think like that way. Well, you know, I've got to get a new license. I've got to whatever. Anyway, I don't get into this stuff. I don't understand it. I don't know a lot of people who actually can understand it, but I'm sure there are people out there, not only Microsoft employees, there's probably non-Microsoft employees whose business it is to understand all that stuff. But so they're pushing really hard. They're making you making it difficult, to say the least, for people to use their software, even to use it properly and ethically. What do I mean by properly and ethically? Well, one copy of the software for every computer that you're running it on. That's what you're supposed to be doing when it's licensed software, when it's proprietary software, not when it's open source software or free software, as Richard Stallman likes to call it. But when you do that and you try to do something other than that, Microsoft is losing money. Well, yeah, it's true. They're losing money on that. So, and there various people have different arguments, and that's, I'm not here to debate that today. But people say, well, if it was didn't cost so much money, if it was more affordable, I would buy it more. Well, if you look back on it, folks, software is a whole hell of a lot cheaper now than it was before. You know, think about it. You used to buy a word processor or buy an accounting module, like an accounts payable module or something. And, I mean, it was like $900 for the one thing. Well, QuickBooks now, you know, for a couple hundred bucks is 1,000 times better than what that one module was, you know, 10 years ago. Or look at the prices of computers. 1989, I bought a 150 meg SD hard drive, ESDI, extended, I can't even remember what it stands for anymore. 150 meg SD hard drive. First of all, that was huge. You know, I was going from like a 40 meg. Now, that's not gig. That's meg, megabytes with an M. Bought that from a friend of mine who had a computer store. He gave me his price on it. How much do you think I paid? Nope, paid more than that. Paid more than that. $1,300. $1,300 for a hard drive. 150 megabytes. I was living large. I've got files that are bigger than 150 megabytes now. $1,300. Well, fast forward that, right? The last one I bought was an 80 gigabyte hard drive for $89. Dollar a gigabyte. I can't even remember how it was, like, you know, whatever, $100 a megabyte back then. I mean, it's crazy. So if you look back with that kind of perspective, the amount of horsepower, everything else we have going now is far better. And that's because of Moore's Law, as they call it. You know, if you haven't heard about Moore's Law, type it into a search engine, check it out sometime. But so computers and technology have been marching along, and that's great. And some people say, well, you know, if it wasn't for Microsoft Windows and, you know, the fact that you have to have bigger hard drives and faster processors and everything, you know, we could still be all getting along with 486s. And hey, you can. Linux runs great on a 486. Well, it runs reasonably well. Let's even face it, with all the graphical things and everything else going on that people are doing nowadays, you know, it's turning out to be in reality. If you want to do anything more than just run like a single app on it, like, you know, have a dedicated firewall box for your Linux or your BSD or whatever you're doing, your those Unish kind of things, those Unix-ish, or Unish as I like to call them, operating systems, you need something more than a 486 processor these days. But, I mean, you can still get some work done. It's still possible to do that. But I think Microsoft is starting to find or is starting to fall victim to the same type of thing that snuck up and bit IBM on the ass in 1987, that the standard is bigger than they are. So Windows XP, yeah, it's great. I run it. I've got it. Yes, I have a licensed copy of it, just in case you're curious, but it came with my laptop. But it's great. It's even better than Windows 2000. Windows 2000 was a pretty good operating system. I mean, XP is even better. It, you know, and I can imagine people are groaning and moaning and rolling their eyes and everything else. But hey, it's out there. It's being used. It's being used 1,000 times more than any Linux or BSD or alternate BOS or Next or even Macintosh operating system is being used out there. So face reality, folks, it's out there. It's being used. It's going to be used. So, but what's going to happen when Microsoft finds out that, as they've been seeing, it's like, you know what? Hey, I don't need to upgrade to Windows XP. My Windows 2000 is working fine. Or well, I don't know how many people would really say this, my Windows 98 is working fine. The whole Nintendo, you know, Windows 95, 98, ME, all that stuff, Nintendo, like Nintendo, you know, was kind of a toy operating system. I mean, it helped bring us along to where we're at now. That's great and good and everything else, but Microsoft is finding that its only competition in the commercial world anyway is itself. So when a person has Windows 98 on their two-year-old computer, why are they going to go out and spend $99 to upgrade to Windows XP when all they have is a Pentium 2 with 64 meg of RAM? Well, then they're going to have to start buying memory. They're going to have to start buying hard drives and everything else. Hey, you know, it's your Aunt Sally in Podunk, Idaho, that just checks email, you know, keep in touch with her grandkids or something, I don't know. And, you know, that's all she needs. So why should she go out and buy that? Well, that's what Microsoft is finding out. There's so many people out there with that are working on those things. It's like the only competition they have is themselves. Same thing with the Office suite, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, all that stuff. They're competing against themselves. They have Office XP. Well, maybe people are buying it when they're getting their new systems, but how many people, whether you're in a corporate America or corporate Euro, you know, corporate Europe or whatever, how many people are going out and buying and upgrading that? Office 2000 works just fine. Hey, Office 97 works fine for enough of the people that are out there that to say, you know what, I can really afford to skip this. I don't need this version. I don't need the next version. Matter of fact, I might not need any version because I'm going to go with OpenOffice.org, but that's getting off into the other side of things. So as we're looking at that, as we're dealing with this kind of thing, we have to realize, folks, or Microsoft really has to realize, that the standard is getting larger than they are. Just because Microsoft comes out with a new operating system doesn't mean people are going to jump to it. Just because they come out with a new network operating system, Windows.net, doesn't mean people are going to jump to it. Hell, there's probably servers out there still with Windows NT 3.5.1. There are certainly lots of Novell 3.1 servers or 3.11 or 3.12. There's lots of servers still running out there, let alone the fact that people are still running Novell, but hey, it's doing the job, it's getting it done. You know, do you run out every year when there's a new car? Well, it's car 2000, it's car 4.5. Isn't kind of silly the way Microsoft was changing that? First it was like, you know, numbers. Everyone kind of dealt with numbers. Then they wanted to change it, was Windows 95. So you could sell where it was. Well, hey, gee, I'm using Windows 95. That's 7 years old now. Maybe I better upgrade. Well, so they had 95, 98, ME, Millennium, Second Edition, all that other stuff. Came with Windows 2000. And then they decided, you know what? Maybe it's not such a good idea thing to go with numbering, by years. Let's call it XP. What's the next one going to be called? I mean, other than the code names like Longhorn and everything else, your guess is as good as mine. But if you just, by the way, if you have access to a Windows 2000 or Windows XP machine, drop to a DOS prompt, click on Start, click on Run, type in CMD, Charles Mary David, Command, CMD for Command, and type Ver and see what you come up with. And you'll see the version number that you come up with. So internally, they're still kind of referring it to it with those numbers, but Microsoft is finding, or is going to find out pretty darn soon, that the standard is bigger than they are. If you didn't catch it on Slashdot a couple of weeks back, go take a look at it. Maybe a little bit longer than that now, but in South America, I think it was in Peru, one of their elected officials in an atypical show of intelligence in elected office actually said, you know what? We need to look at saving money. We're spending all this money. We're sending it off to those damn Americans. You know, Microsoft is taking all these, you know, thousands and millions of dollars out of our country as we're buying this software. Maybe there's an alternative. Oh, looky there. There's open source software. There's free software. And as Stallman says, it's not only free as in free beer, meaning it doesn't cost you anything, it's free as in freedom, as in you can do with it what you want. You don't like the way this looks, you don't like the way this works, you want something else, hey, you've got the source code, you can change it. Oh, you're not a programmer? Hey, find someone who is. You've got the ability to do that, you've got all the tools in your hands, you can change things as you need to. So anyway, this South American politician, I think he had a PhD in economics or something as well, which probably didn't hurt, came up with the proposal for the government that as they're looking at software, they have to, just to be responsible with their taxpayers' money, they have to look at other alternatives other than proprietary software. Well, Microsoft in that country wrote a nice letter back, kind of rebutting all the points, and saying why commercial software as opposed to proprietary software, why commercial software was a good thing. And you know what? It is a good thing. It's not necessarily bad. Lots of people are using it. Lots of people are happy. It's just when you see things happen where they're trying to force those proprietary solutions, those commercial solutions down your throat, or worse, they're taking advantage of the fact that they've got these hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. In case you haven't heard, Microsoft has $40 billion in cash reserves. So think of which of your favorite companies, think of which of your favorite countries they could buy with that money. But that fact aside, being responsible politicians, which is almost an oxymoron by itself, they're saying we have to look at alternatives. Microsoft wrote this rebuttal back, and there's some interesting things. You can find that online. Again, one of my favorite places for keeping up on that news stuff is slash.org. But as you go there and take a look through things, you will see that things are happening. Things are starting to shake up, and if Microsoft doesn't see the writing on the wall, they really should. There was something posted online today that Ralph Nader wrote to Congress or something, and saying that the government should use its purchase, the U.S. government that is, should use its purchasing power to say, you know, if we're going to be using your programs, you have to, we're going to require you to make those file formats available. That's not such an outlandish kind of request. The federal government spending millions and billions of taxpayers' dollars on things, that's not an outlandish request. And oh, by the way, that would just happen to benefit the rest of the computer using world by making those file formats available. Other things you may have seen, like the Pentagon, they're looking at their spending, how they're spending their money on that, and should things be proprietary software, commercial software, or can you actually go with open source software, free software? And in all deference to Richard Stallman, I know there are some differences out there with it. I'm not completely versed on that, so I'll try to, if I use the term open source, I'll try to make sure I put in the term free software in there as well, because there are some subtle distinctions between that. But I've been playing with openoffice.org, which also happens to be the website, but that's, for legal reasons, has to be the name of the product. And I'm telling you what, folks, it's looking pretty darn good. I mean, I played with some of the betas. I had a Microsoft PowerPoint presentation that I did. I decided to open it up in openoffice.org. Well, the Windows metafiles didn't come out quite right. This didn't quite work. That didn't quite work. But it was a beta. It was working pretty well. Got to the 1.0 release code. I'll be darned, all those little problems I was having went away. Everything is displaying just fine now. So companies, individuals, governmental agencies, not only federal government, but state government, municipal government, or, you know, insert the proper governmental agency for your country or municipality in here, they are looking at some of these alternatives and saying, hey, you know what? Maybe there is another way other than what Microsoft is doing. And that's probably part of the reason that Microsoft is pushing back so hard on a lot of these things is because, let's face it, folks, Microsoft is not dumb, okay? There are a lot of smart people there. You know, I'm not going to comment on the, you know, greed or anything else in that. Say what you want about that. That's fine. That's your opinion. Whether you like their products or not, hey, they're out there. It's a fact of life. You know, it's like talking about the weather. Something going to happen with it? Who knows? The U.S. federal government is taking steps against them, the Federal Trade Commission. You read articles and see things in Europe that people are getting fed up with things. In the European Union and some of the individual countries are looking at doing different types of things. And There was even, again, today, online, something about Taiwan. The government of Taiwan is looking at using free software to save all that money. And if you think about it, you know, technology is, you know, the cost of all that technology. I mean, in Taiwan is great for hardware. They, you know, I don't know what kind of percentage of hardware that we have here in the U.S. comes from, you know, Taiwan and Korea and Japan and China, but certainly a large percentage of it does. The Apple iMac computers made by Quanta Corporation in Taiwan. Dell, some of the Dell laptop computers are made in Taiwan. So, you know, it's an international marketplace here, folks. So, you know, those companies, the countries are making money on that. That's great. Nothing wrong with that. But as they're starting to look at things, they're saying, well, we're making money on this, but look at all the money we're shipping back out to the United States, back off to Microsoft. Maybe there's an alternative. You know, now maybe things are mature enough that there's an alternative. And, you know, what I really resent is when you see a large company taking advantage of the fact that they have the power, they have the money. I mean, money is power. Knowledge is power. That's true. Money is power as well. So they're taking advantage of the fact that they have all this money, that they have this power to squelch the competition. The cool thing about free software, about open source, since there is no one person out there doing things, I mean, with Linux, you know, Linus Torvald is certainly the key figure in that whole realm. You know, in BSD, there's a whole series of people who are committers. And there's, you know, there's other things for that in various projects that are distributed. So rather than having one centralized place or one centralized company they can go against, they have to change their tactics because they can no longer just threaten to sue one person or one company. They have to change their tactics and start competing on their merits. And face it, Microsoft has the lion's share. They have the lead. We have a long way to go to catch up with open source software, with free software, with Linux, with BSD, and even to some extent with Macintosh. Macintosh is great products again these days, but look at the percentages. And people in countries, as I said, are starting to look at that type of thing. What kind of alternatives do we have? If we can't get it from Microsoft, who could we get it from? If Microsoft was blown off the face of the earth, which I know some people would certainly like to see, what could we do as an alternative? And guess what, folks? These days, alternatives are starting to show up. Okay, let's change directions here a little bit, and let's talk about some of the tools of hacking, or some of the resources for hacking. I mean, that could be a whole separate show just on, you know, various utilities and things out there. Let's talk about some of the resources for hacking, for finding information. One of my favorite, AstaLaVista.com, AstaLaVista.com. Great information there. And there's, matter of fact, if you go there and do a little search, you'll find a tutorial basically by someone calling himself Ray Biez, B-I-E-Z, on how to basically develop a serial number generator, a key number generator. And the interesting thing about this, other than the obvious fact of, you know, what you can get as a result of it, it goes through and it uses Adobe, for example, but it goes through and it talks about looking at that information, the various segments of the information that make up serial numbers, and then it gets down to the numbers that are really involved in there. Basically seem to be random. The last segment is a checksum, a mathematical algorithm applied to the previous numbers that results in a specific number. And he walks you through a little tutorial in figuring those types of things out. So as I'm reading that, I'm saying, well, that's very cool. You know, I've never written a key generator, never had a need to do anything like that, but it was just interesting and intriguing when you look at something like that. And he walks you through. So it's a tutorial. There are tutorials for tons and tons and tons of information, different types of things. I mean, tutorials from everything of, you know, setting up your Windows box to let it do internet connection sharing, to writing key generators, to just about anything else you can think of. So AstaLaVista.com or AstaLaVista.net is a great resource for that. Another one that happens to have AstaLaVista as well in its name is AstaLaVista.box.box.sk for Sweden. And at that site, there is tons and tons of information as well in various categories. As a matter of fact, if you just go to hastalavista.box.sk, they have the whole box network that you can go to. New Order, which basically deals with, it says, the resource for helping people avoid being hacked, security and exploitation files and related links. So that's neworder.box.sk. There's an area there for Linux. There's a code area. There's a mobile area, DVDs, MP3s. I mean, there's just tons and tons and tons of information at the Box Network, box.sk. So, and oh yes, just by the way, in case anyone sitting here in the you know, the great planet of North America thinks that all this stuff is just developed and just done here, sorry folks, it's definitely international. It's live. It's large. It's out there for the whole world. And that's the other kind of neat thing about the net, is that in addition to being a very democratizing type of force, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're coming up with a cool idea and you're in you know, Silicon Valley, California, or you're up in some fjord and you know, in the Scandinavian country, or no matter where you're at, South America, I mean, name any place on the earth, if you can get a net connection, you have as much power and the ability to publish information as anyone does anywhere else. And for our international listeners, here's, you know, a great little joke is, what do you call people who speak three languages? Well, they're trilingual. People who speak two languages, they're bilingual. People that speak one language, well, you call them Americans. It's anyway, it seems kind of funny to me, and you talk to anyone who's from a different country, they tend to chuckle with that as well, because we don't necessarily, here in the U.S., we don't necessarily take the time to learn all those other things that we could out there. But the whole Box Network definitely is a great resource. Hastalavista.box.sk has tons and tons of information for you. What else? 2600.com. 2600 gets back to the phone freaking type of things. That, of course, was the frequency for making blue boxes, for making dial tones to play with the phone system. But 2600.com and the magazine is called, you know, they have their magazine out. It's called the Hacker Quarterly. It comes out four times every year. But there's tons of information that's shared there as well. And as a matter of fact, as I'm taking a look at it here, 37 days remain today. So when you hear the show, 36 days remain until H2K2 conference in New York. For those folks going there, H2K2, the original one was Hope Hackers on Planet Earth. And anyway, long story made short, this is a new one coming up July 12th to 14th in New York. If you're going there, maybe we can hook up, check out, hang out. We'll be there. Duel and I are both planning on going up there and being there for the fun and festivities. So 2600 has a lot of great information. When you go there, click on the meetings section as well. That talks about meetings in hopefully your local area. Now, you may find that it's not necessarily 100% completely correct or completely updated. I started going to 2600 meetings back in about August or September, I think it was, and I went to the 2600 mag, you know, picked up a magazine, saw where the meeting was, went there, and actually ended up running into a few folks, you know, there at the designated meeting place. Kind of easy to see when they had, you know, T-shirts with, you know, various computer type of sayings on there. You know, you just walk up to someone and do the old greeting. You say 2600, and they say yeah, or they say, what are you talking about? And you just walk away. But you go there. What we found out, and we've moved it out into, it was in a mall, and it was in one of the stores in the mall in the restaurant. Well, we found it wasn't very conducive, so we moved it out into the food court, where most places seem to be for the 2600 meetings. And we're having a heck of a time trying to get them to update that for the 2600 in our area. Maybe when we're off in New York and seeing people face-to-face, maybe we'll be able to get some action for that. So bottom line is, if you don't find it there, you know, don't be discouraged. You know, look around in the area. If there's a food court, generally things, too, people seem to hang out. The kind of the default thing is to meet by the telephones and then, you know, pick a place to sit down after that. So keep that in mind as you're doing your 2600 things. And if you're you know, if there's not one in your area, think about starting one. Check out, they've got the meeting guidelines online that you can see, and you know, it's open to everybody. That's one of the things. It has to be a publicly accessible, publicly open thing, because there's nothing to hide. This is my first H2K2 that I'm going to. I went to DEF CON last year, and I mean, you know, it's great. I mean, there's everyone from, you know, the pale faced, pale skinned, black T-shirt wearing, you know, Uber geeks to guys in their khakis and polo shirts that work for various federal agencies, and they're all there, and they're, you know, all for the same kind of thing: learning information, finding information, sharing information. I'm not sure how much information the feds can share, but they're at least they're learning, so it's kind of an interesting atmosphere to go to and see that. So we're looking forward to that. And if you're going to DEF CON, be sure to try to find us. We ought to have some old school freak shirts that we'll be wearing, and we'll make them available to other folks if they're interested in doing that as well. So, anyway, hacking is not just about breaking into computers. Hopefully, we've gotten that message across. It's about finding clever solutions to things. For example, we've talked about it a little bit on the show before. The new Celine Dion CD is supposedly impervious to copying. It crashes computers if you actually even just try to play the CD in there. Now, I'm not a big Celine Dion fan, so I don't know that I'd really be worried about that, but the implications of that are great. I mean, if that would take off there, who knows what other kinds of things are going to try to put it on. So, you can go and find out without too much difficulty how to defeat copy protection with a magic marker, with a felt tip pen. Again, not too hard to find out, and technically, you know, with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, now felt tip pens should be illegal, because that allows people to defeat the copy protection. So that's a very bad thing. But you know what? I say it's a clever hack. It's a really cool way that someone figured out how to do something. Another thing you may have seen that's a clever hack is these biometrics. You know, measuring something on the human body for identification. People have been doing, face recognition. We all know about the implications of that. But they've been doing fingerprints. And you can even buy some laptops now. I think Micron has some laptops now with fingerprint readers built in. And, well, it turns out that a clever hacker in Japan, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name here, but long story made short, he figured out by using regular household kind of things you can find in a little circuit board etcher for making computer circuit boards and stuff. And anyway, bottom line is basically using gummy bears, you can fake out these fingerprint readers. If you want to read more about it, go to counterpane, counterpane.com, and type in the word gummy bear, G-U-M-M-I, gummy B-E-A-R, and it gives all the details about it. And the cool thing about that is, I mean, it's a very clever hack, but as one of the other articles I was reading about it was saying, basically, all the companies that are doing biometrics for recognition basically should pack it in. I mean, that kind of defeats their whole thing. It's like, gee, you know, we figured out a way to open up the envelope to see what's inside. You know, it's just not that secure. And the thing is, if people didn't publish this kind of information, only the real bad guys would have this type of stuff. You know, it won't have to be like the movies you see where, you know, they cut off someone's thumb to get past the fingerprint readers. They'll just be able to grab a fingerprint off something like a glass. Again, this article in Counterpane talks about it. Get that fingerprint, cast it into, you know, make it basically like into a little mold, and, you know, make your own duplicate of that fingerprint using gummy bears. You kind of melt down the gummy bears and it takes the shape of that. So, a very clever hack. Another clever hack is, and I was trying to get one to play for you here as we were closing out the show, but Dictionary-Oki, if you haven't heard about it. It's dictionary, pronunciation of various words, Merriam-Webster Dictionary at m-w.com, and other dictionaries online. You can go in, type a word, it gives you the definition, you can click on a little icon, and it gives you the pronunciation of the word. Very cool. I mean, I'm interested in language. I click on things, type in words that I'm not really sure of, words that I'm not necessarily sure of how to pronounce. And you get the pronunciation. Well, that's great and they're fine and everything, but some clever hack somewhere figured out that something really cool to do would be to get a MIDI of your favorite song. And instead of the lyrics, instead of singing the lyrics like you would with traditional karaoke, now it takes a bit of time, I'm sure, but you go and take all of the words, the lyrics, you save those sounds from these online dictionaries, and you have the dictionary people sing the song. Well, it's hilarious. And like I say, I'll try to see if I can find one to dig up here, but I think my favorite one was from Nine Inch Nails, Closer. And to hear the dictionary people sing the lyrics or pronounce the lyrics of that particular song is kind of interesting, kind of funny. But that's what it's all about, figuring out clever things to do. You know, defacing a website, that's just vandalism. I'm sorry, call it cyber vandalism if you want. What some people do, they'll go and they'll find out things. They will leave a message. They'll try to contact the SysOp. That shows you how old school I am. They'll try to contact the webmaster, the system operator of those computer systems, and let them know that they're vulnerable. And unfortunately, this litigious society that we live in, generally when people do that, they have to do it anonymously to, you know, try to prevent any kind of negative repercussions from doing that thing. But there's also things called white hat hackers. There's companies that are doing things. Used to be Loft Heavy Industries. Can't think of the name now of what they do. Their new website thing, but they Loft was making, you know, password crackers and other kinds of things. And I mean, they found out that companies were coming to them and say, hey, you guys know about security, you can figure out things, I'll pay you X number of dollars, see if you can penetrate my securities. You know, tell me what's wrong with the security on my network. And so when you're doing it with the blessing, with the sanction of the people that own the equipment and own the services, that's called white hat hacking. And it's certainly a way to make a living. Is it less fun because it's legal? I don't know. That's up to you. You know, certainly I'm not interested in, you know, spending time in any kind of prison and making friends there. And I'm taking some of these things and I'm applying the techniques and tools and that I know of and learn. I'm making those things available for my clients. I want to help them have a better environment. And I think most hackers out there that are doing things, you know, except for the crackers, except for the attackers out there, they want to ultimately see things be better. So if people find out solutions to things, you know, like this fingerprint hack that this Japanese guy came up with, if he just kept that information to himself, or just, you know, traded it with some other, you know, quote unquote friends, if it got into the underground, only those people would know about it, and it would be exploitable, certainly. So by making it generally available to the public, you are actually doing a service to them. Companies, Microsoft included, have tried to come up with ways of not allowing people to make that information generally available right away, to let the company have that information so they can fix it. But you know, if you hold people up to the light of day sometimes, it tends to motivate things a little bit more. You know, if people know about it, if the whole world knows about the fact that you can bypass fingerprint biometrics by going through a couple of steps, do you think the companies out there that were thinking about buying biometrics, do you think they're probably going to go through that, or biometric fingerprinting, I should say, do you think they're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on these solutions thinking that they're secure? Hell no. They need to know that just as well as everybody else needs to know that. Knowledge needs to be free. Keeping information free, keeping knowledge free about that. Is there proprietary stuff that needs to be kept control of, kept under wraps? In the corporate environment, I'm sure most people would say yes. Certainly for security, national security, there are certain things that definitely need to be kept under wraps for that. Unfortunately, especially in the wake of September 11th, that whole thing has been certainly blown out of proportion. The Patriot Act is something going on here in the U.S. It's basically making it a felony to do all kinds of things, including illegal entry into computer systems. And we've talked about this a little bit before. Patriot, by the way, is an acronym. I don't have it at my fingertips what it stands for, but it's not, you know, people think, oh, I don't want to be unpatriotic. Well, guess what, folks? It's a little bit of smoke and mirrors, or it's a little bit of media kind of misconception with that. It is actually an acronym standing for something, but you know, it appeals to that patriotic nature in everybody that they don't want to be unpatriotic and do these things against their country. Certainly, you know, I'm not encouraging you do things against the country. I'm not encouraging you to do things against companies. I'm encouraging you to think creatively, find solutions, and share that information with other people. If we can take and share all this information back and forth with people, we can improve the quality of the technology, the quality of information. Hell, it'll even eventually, once it is spread enough, can help to improve the quality of life. You know, there's the whole big thing about the digital divide, the haves and have-nots. There are certainly, you know, other countries rather than, you know, U.S., Canada, and Western Europe where technology is not that readily available. There are a whole lot of people out there that can benefit by it. Of course, you know, they need basic things like food and shelter and clothing before they, you know, start worrying about computers. But if we all can try to work together, if we can help keep corporate America's greedy hand out of everything, if we can help keep the government honest by sharing this information, we can end up benefiting everybody else. And I don't know about you, but that's what I'm in it for. You know, it's fun. It's you know, it's all that other stuff, but you know, I think it's basically ending up coming down to helping people. At any rate, that'll wrap up the show for today. Next week, we'll see if we can get Slipping Away or Condor back on the line. They were supposed to be calling in this week. I guess it just didn't end up happening. Duel's still going to be off on assignment, working away on some stuff. So we'll be talking to you later. See you online. Check us out at www.oldschoolfreak.com. For Duel Parallel, who always says, be the media. I'm Rax. Keep knowledge free.
Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.